question mark refers to the lack of theorems. I want to talk about a joint program that Peter Teichner and myself have been working on for a number of years now, and some of you have heard me give talk on various aspects of that. And so the most part I'll talk about will be, you know, sort of this program and what we hope to prove someday. Good question. Is it turned on? Maybe I should talk louder. Okay, sounds good. All right, so I want to talk about elliptic cohomology. And there are various flavors of elliptic cohomology. The flavor I'm thinking of is TMF, which is the topological modular form spectrum. Of Miller and Hopkins. And the relation to modular forms is that you have a map from the homotopy groups of this spectrum into modular forms. So let me denote by MFN the modular forms. Of degree n. Usually you measure modular forms in weight. I find this more convenient, so that means I'm talking about modular forms of weight n over 2. And when I talk about modular forms, I don't want to assume that they are holomorphic at infinity. My modular forms are not necessarily, or might, let's say it this way, might have poles. Poles at infinity. And I want to talk about integral modular forms. So I want to just remind you of what integral modular forms are. So modular form is, in particular, a holomorphic map from the upper half plane, which has this funny transformation property that f of a tau plus b divided by c tau plus d is equal to c d plus c tau plus d to the minus n over 2 times f of tau. So in particular, you have this property, and that should hold for all matrices A, B, C, D, SL2Z. So in particular, you see that plugging in A equal to 1, B equal to 0, C 0, and D 1, that you have this translation property that the function doesn't change its values if you shift by one in horizontal directions. So in particular, you can then pass to the variable q, which is just e to the 2 pi I tau, and this function f of tau can be expressed in terms of q, and it will have, since it's holomorphic, a Q expansion, a raw expansion around zero. So you write it in this form, where the N has nothing to do with the weight of the form, the degree of the form. Starts somewhere, goes up to infinity. So this is the so-called Q expansion of the modular form. And saying that my modular form is integral just means, in terms of this, that the coefficients that I pick up in the Q expansion are integral. Okay. So it's a lowbrow definition of what integral modular form means. Okay, so what... What we want to ask ourselves is this homotopy theoretic gadget, which is defined by taking elliptic curves and sort of doing something with them as topologists, as Jacob Lurie explained in his talk, what we like to do is we'd like to understand what does this mean geometrically. What's the geometric meaning? Of TMF. So what we have in mind is something to say analogous.
Is that map on?
No. It has, there are divisibilities. For example, the discriminant is not in the image of this map, but I believe it's completely known what it's onto. Yeah, so this is rationally onto. In fact, I meant to say, so rationally, this map is an isomorphism. So, Q, isomorphism. Okay, so what we mean by geometric interpretation of that is something analogous to the statement that if you look at the K-theory spectrum, and you take its zero space, well, there are many interpretations of it, but in particular, that's homotopy equivalent to the space of Fredholm operators. And that fact was really important for the development of, say, index theory. That makes it possible to do index theory. So having a geometric interpretation of these homotopy theoretic gadgets really helps to connect it with other areas. All right, so, well, in some ways, of course, it is connected already with sort of number theory, so from the built-in definition, but number theory is not exactly geometry. So we should ask, well, are there sources in geometry where modular forms come up naturally? And sort of one source for modular forms in geometry slash physics is the partition function. I'm going to explain these things. Of CFT, which stands for conformal field theory. Has the transformation properties of a modular form. What I'm saying is you have this property that this F, how the function behaves under transformation, under SL to Z. I'm not saying that the partition function is natural, is always holomorphic, or has always an integral Q expansion. So I need to define that. Let me sort of skip over it for the time being. Let me look at what the plan was here. No, let me actually dive into giving you a rough definition of these thing. So I want to use the axiomatization of quantum field theories due to Atiyah Segal. And I want to use a very rough version of the definition. So I'm lying for the time being and correct later. So a d-dimensional quantum field theory is a functor from a Bordism category into the category of Hilbert spaces. So the objects here are D minus one dimensional manifolds. Object here is just the Hilbert space. A morphism is a d-dimensional Bordism from a d minus one manifold into another one, and you associate to that a bounded operator. So these are the morphisms in that category. Now, there are various flavors of quantum field theories depending on what geometry you have, in particular on the morphisms in your Bordism category. Flavors are conformal field theory, and the word conformal indicates that on these d-dimensional Bordisms you have a conformal structure. On the Bordisms, so on the morphisms in your Bordism category, or a Euclidean field theory means you have a Euclidean structure on your Bordisms, or in other words, a metric, a Riemannian metric, or you have a topological field theory. Well, the first T stands for topological. And that means, yeah, you don't have any geometric structure on there. Well, there's no geometric structure. The way I'm thinking about it is you are equipped the boundary with a little tubular neighborhood. So it's really sitting inside sort of a germ of a Bordism. And you need that to do the gluing. But I sort of sit that under the carpet. Yeah, I think of it that this boundary is embedded in a little conformal collar. And it might not be a product structure, but it's embedded somehow. Okay. So then there's some axioms for these functors. And I don't want to spell out all the axioms. I give you one now and one a little bit later. The one that I want to talk about now is if you have such a functor, maybe I sort of squeeze this underneath here, what you can do on the geometric side is you can take disjoint union on these things. Right. Joint union. And that gives this category the structure of a symmetric monoidal category. And that should correspond to tensor product of these algebraic objects. So it's a symmetric monoidal functor, in other words. So that has some consequences, namely, if you, what is the unit with respect to disjoint union? Well, that's the empty set. So that should go to the unit on the algebraic side. Well, that's the complex numbers. So in particular, CE applied to the empty set, that would give you C on objects. So in particular, if you have a closed manifold, and you can think of it as a Bordism from the empty set to the empty set, so then E of that would be a bounded operator from Hilbert space associated to the empty set. So itself, well, those are just copies of C, so you're just talking about a number. So in other words, this here is just a complex number. So you can take conformal field theory or any field theories and evaluate them on closed manifolds of dimension D, and you get a number. And that's sort of what you do in order to get the partition function. Of a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And actually, so you could evaluate it on any Riemann surface of genus G, but actually you'll concentrate on genus 1 surfaces, and you just evaluate it on a torus. And there, the only thing that matters is the isomorphism class of that. So when I say here d-dimensional Bodisms, it's actually up to isomorphism. So what you do is, yeah, you represent all the tori as C modulo suitable lattice. So in other words, you take a point in the upper half plane, and then you make the standard lattice out of it, V tau plus V1. And then you make a torus out of it. Well, let me call it T sub tau, which you get by modding out this lattice. And then you can evaluate your conformal field theory on that torus, E of that torus. Well, that's a complex number. And the function which maps tau to this torus, well, that's an element in the upper half plane, that is called the partition function, and I'll denote it by Z sub E. So this is the partition function. And it is clear that this has the transformation properties of a modular form, since if you replace, actually of a modular function, since if you replace the tau by another element in this orbit of the SL2Z action, you get a conformally equivalent torus, so you get the same number. So you might be wondering, wait a minute, we want modular forms, we don't want modular functions. Well, that's a different layer that I won't get to this in this talk, actually. Namely, you have to modify this category suitably by taking into account the Pfaffian lines that are floating around here, and I will suppress that. All right, so the partition function, after you define properly what you mean by a CFT, that gives you a modular, that gives you at least something that smells like a modular form in that it has the same transformation property. Now, a theorem that I want to state says, No, you need to modify this category here by putting in extra data. So, for example, on the level of closed manifolds, you want to say, you, in this two-dimensional case, you don't want to say you associate a number to a Riemann surface. You want a Riemann surface together with an element in the Pfaffian line of that, and out of that, you get a number. And then you need to put in what is the appropriate analog of an element in the Pfaffian line for manifolds with boundary. Yeah, I have spin structures on all my Riemann surfaces. And then you need to generalize that, and you put that in the definition of a category, and then you have the same definition. So let me state this theorem. Which says the partition function, so well, let's state it this way. So if E is supersymmetric, conformal field theory of degree n, then its partition function is actually an integral modular form of weight n. So in other words, if you put in supersymmetry, you get holomorphy of your partition function, and you get integrality of your partition function. You might not get that you don't have poles at infinity. Okay? Now, there's a lot of undefined terms, but let me, for a moment, leave those undefined and sort of outline what the big hope that Peter and I are following is. So if you look at that, you're saying, oh, okay, so these supersymmetric CFTs of degree n, whatever they are good objects. They have to do with modular forms. So why not then build a space out of these guys? If you look at the space of supersymmetric CFTs of degree 1, degree n, and they should also be enriched. And let's call the space CFT sub n. Well, then, what this theorem does for you is, if you look at this space, it gives you an invariant for the components of the space, right? Since you can associate to each such theory its partition function, that's the modular form of weight n. Let's see, which associates to a Euclidean, to a conformal field theory E, its partition function. And clearly, since the coefficients of this partition function are integral, as you move around in your moduli space, they can jump. And so that will only depend on the component of this field theory E. Okay, so then if you compare sort of that map and that map, and you're a real optimist, you're saying, well, gee, so maybe this space should have something to do with the spaces that come up in the construction of TMF. So the hope is that if you look at the space of conformal field theories of degree n, that that is homotopy equivalent to the space that you get if you loop TMF down to get a space and you loop it n times more. And I'm thinking here of n as being some integer. You could also loop it less if you want to. This notion of degree makes sense for any integer n. Well, let me spell out right, that would be the first step, and then hopefully you can prove that it's a homotopy equivalent somehow. So in particular, you want to first of all show that the spaces CFTN, that they fit together into an infinite loop spectrum, right? That's the first step. And then if you get that, then you could wonder, well, how are we going to compare that to TMF? Let me spell out the consequences of if you get a positive answer here. So let's think about the homotopy classes of maps from X into the space of conformal field theories degree n. If this is true, then this would say, well, we can put this space in there. And then this here I can rewrite as saying, well, this is TMF minus n of the space X. So that would give you an interpretation of TMF cohomology as parameterizing families of conformal field theories parameterized by your space X. So that would give you a very strong geometric physical interpretation of what TMF cohomology means. So in particular, if you just look at pi 0 of CFTN, that would then be equal to TMF upper minus n of a point, or in other words, the n coefficient in the homology theory. Now, let me make some remarks. So, physicists claim that they can do the following. Suppose you have a string manifold . So string means that you have a spin structure on this manifold, and this first Pendragon class over 2 is 0. And let's assume also that you have a Riemannian metric on here, which is Ricci flat. Then the physicist thinks that it should be possible to talk about the so-called sigma model of M, and that is a conformal field theory of the degree equal to the dimension of N. Conformal field theory of degree N. So this is not constructed in a mathematical rigorous way, but I think physicists very strongly think that, yes, in the Ricci flat case, at least, that one can produce these operators that give you a CFT. Now, if this hope works out, there would be a topologist's way of producing something like that. I mean, here's what you can do. So take your string manifold and look at its Bordism class, which lives in the Bordism group of string manifolds, dimension n. And of course, that we can interpret by the Pontryagin-Thom construction as the nth homotopy group of the appropriate Thom spectrum, M string. So it's a Thom spectrum. And then out of this Thom spectrum, there is the so-called sigma orientation that Mike Hopkins, Matt Ando, and Neil Strickland, so a combination of these people, produced. So that would give you a map from here into pi n of TMF. And that, by the previous thing, we can then interpret, if the hope is correct, as an element in pi 0 of CFT. And so, in other words, if you follow this thing here, call this sigma of n, that's sort of it's a topologist version of a CFT, since we haven't really defined then a CFT on the nose, but we've defined one up to homotopy. I was wondering, since this is called sigma model, and this is called a sigma orientation, it seems like such a nice coincidence. Was that meant to give this coincidence? Okay. Right. It works out beautifully. Okay. Okay. All right. Slightly more general, what you could do is, you could look at a family of string manifolds and go through this construction, and then at the end of the day, you would get a map from the parameter space of this string family X into the space CFTN. So it really looks like you up to homotopy, could construct all these things that one would like to construct on the nose. Anyway, these are sort of the science fiction part of the talk. Here's a I would like to do that in private discussion. So, I mean, they have their ways of doing things and their local anomalies running around, and they have to do with the Ricci curvature. But I'm not sure that I'm qualified to talk about that. Maybe Kentaro can talk with him about these things. Yes, I mean, I'm assuming now that the hope is correct, and that would then follow without any geometric construction. Yeah. All right, now let me step.
I'm wondering about a cardinality issue. I mean, any construction you make with reasonable algebraic quality involved will count as any thing.
Right, right. And so I need to say, what do I mean by the space of these things? Right. Right. Let me discuss the analogous thing for Euclidean field theories, and there I'll be more precise. So now I want to step back and do an easier case, sort of as a warm-up, which will have to do with K-theory. So I want to basically drop dimension by one, and instead of looking at two-dimensional quantum field theory, I want to look at a one-dimensional conformal field theory. So let me denote by EFT sub n the space of one-dimensional Euclidean field theories. And here I want to again add the adjective supersymmetric degree n. And what I mean by that is, so here, super field theory is a functor from this Bordism category, the Euclidean version of it, into Hilbert spaces. And to get it set, I want to insist that the Hilbert space that I get if I evaluate it on a point is a fixed Hilbert space that I pick as my universe. H. Now this is a fixed Hilbert space. So here we have one adjective less. We don't have the enriched that we had in this space of CFTs. Still, there then are sort of two things, supersymmetric and the degree that has to be explained. I'm afraid I will only have time to explain one of these adjectives. In previous talks, I explained some other adjectives, so maybe that is complementary to some of you who've heard the others. So I'll concentrate on the supersymmetric aspect, and I'll skip the enriched, and I'll skip the degree, except maybe to say that the enriched means that you're really passing to two categories, and instead of just having two-dimensional surfaces and one-dimensional things, you also go down to points. So that forms the two category, and then there's a corresponding algebraic two category here, and an enriched conformal field theory is really a two functor. Okay, but now we're down to this one here. So we pick once and for all a Hilbert space, and then the only thing that varies is, well, for each one-dimensional manifold, for each Bordism here, we have sort of a varying family of operators. That we know how to topologize by the weak topology, and so this is an okay topological space. Now, what can we say about this? What turns out is that if you look at this space here, it is closely related to the K-theory spectrum. Maybe if you take this loop space of the K-theory spectrum, that's the homotopy type of this space. So in particular, if you look at families of Euclidean field theories up to homotopy, so they are given by homotopy classes of such map, that's then just the K-theory of the parameterizing space. So if you want to, you can always interpret K-theory of a space as families of Euclidean field theories parameterized by that space. Now, there are much easier models for K-theory, of course, so you might not want to do that. So let me give you an example of a Euclidean field theory. Example. EFT. So suppose that M is a spin manifold. I'm thinking of a closed spin manifold here. Then you have the Dirac operator. Noted D slash, since I have another operator D running around later. Then what you can do is you can look at the operator e to the minus t d squared. Let's see, I'm getting ahead of myself. I should first say what the space is. So then you define a EFT e sub m as follows. So first of all, I need to say, well, what it is for a point. And the Hilbert space that I associate to a point is just the space of L2 spinners on my spin manifold M. And then I need to say, well, sort of to every one manifold, to every Bodhism, I want to associate an operator. So in particular, to the interval 0t, I want to associate an operator acting on the space. And this operator is going to be this. Now, I haven't given you yet a whole Euclidean field theory, since there are a lot more one-manifolds than just the interval. However, every Riemannian one-manifold can be built up from the interval by gluing. You can glue two of these to a circle. So any one-manifold can get that way. So these here, these data really extend uniquely to an EFT. Let me point out that this has interesting topological information contained in it. Let me take the supertrace of this operator to the spinner bundle is Z2 graded, to the space of section is going to be a Z2 graded Hilbert space. And then you can talk about the supertrace dimension, the trace of the even part minus the trace on the odd part. And that is equal to the index of the Dirac operator if you restrict it to the sections of the plus spinner bundle, which in topological terms is the Airoof genus of M. So I'm assuming that the dimension of my manifold is congruent 0 mod 8. Oh, this just means the restriction. So the Dirac operator acts on the full spinner bundle, and I'm restricting it to the even spinners. Since otherwise the Dirac operator on the full thing is self-adjoint, so the index would be 0. Okay. All right, so it seems we have something going here. Now, let me make the following definition. So let's say H is a Hilbert space, D2 graded. And let's just say I'll define EFT. Yes, absolutely, right. Yep. Let me call EFT of H, the space of all EFTs E, which has a property that if I evaluate the EFT on a point, I get my fixed Hilbert space H. And so let's try to understand this space. Now the here I mentioned that whenever you have an EFT, as long as you know what it is for an interval, you know what it is on a general one manifold. So what this is saying is this space is really homeomorphic to the space of homomorphisms from the positive real line into operators, right? The idea is if I have a field theory E here, I can evaluate it by looking at, well, what is it on, what is the operator that I get associated to the interval of length T? Now, if you look at the axioms that I didn't write down a little closer, you see that the operator associated to any Bordism automatically has to be a Hilbert-Schmidt operator. So this will be, this operator associated to the interval will be a Hilbert-Schmidt operator from the Hilbert space associated to the point, which is my H, into H. And also it will be a self-adjoint, so HS stands for Hilbert-Schmidt, and SA stands for self-adjoint. So you will get, in other words, a semi-group of Hilbert-Schmidt operators, of self-adjoint Hilbert-Schmidt operators on this vector space H, and that's really what an EFT is. Now you think about this space, and you'll see that this is contractible. And what you can do is, suppose that you have such a semi-group of Hilbert-Schmidt operators, how can you contract that? Well, what you can do is you can just look at the new Hilbert-Schmidt operator that's given by multiplying your old Hilbert-Schmidt operator by s to the t, where s is just some number in the interval between 0 and 1. If s is equal to 1, you get your old semigroup. And if s is equal to 0, well, you're at the base point. That's the contraction of this space. So that's a contractible space. Well, that's not good. But it's confusing, right? Since before in the example, I said, well, we get interesting information about the manifold. We see the index. So how is that compatible with the contractibility here? Well, the point is this. Look at it. Look at what this thing is in the example above. So there, we get s to the t times e to the minus t Dirac squared. Well, let's rewrite this. We could write it as e to the minus t times d squared minus the log of s. So, what's the difference sort of between this guy and the original guy? Well, in the original guy, the infinitesimal generator of this semigroup of operators was the square of an odd operator. Whereas this is not the square of an odd operator. This is the square of an odd operator. And this here is not the square. And the nice property that you have is whenever you have a semigroup generated by something which is the square of an odd operator, then the supertrace is independent of the parameter t. Let me make a remark. For if A is of the form square of some operator, D is odd, that implies that if you look at the supertrace of e to the minus t a, that this is a independent of t, and b, it's an integer. The reason it's an integer is, well, as you let your t go to infinity, and then only the kernel of A contributes. So you're just picking up the dimension of the kernel of the operator. And so what this number is, in that case, is just the kernel of the operator A, or the superdimension of that kernel. Right, and so that's the point. We did not contract the space in a way that would preserve that the operator is the square of an odd operator. So somehow we should build in that whatever this semi-group is, that its infinitesimal generator is the square of something. So let me do another remark. Look at this homomorphism from R into Hilbert-Schmidt operator, which is something of this form. T goes to e to the minus t d squared. Then you could differentiate this, so from this homomorphism of groups, on the corresponding Lie algebras, you get that ddt, so I'm thinking about the Lie algebra of that as sort of the vector field, span by the vector field ddt, well, so I differentiate that, that is just minus d squared. So in other words, somehow, in order to ensure that this generator is a square, which should make sure that this thing here, that this vector field on R, is a square of a vector field. So, sort of hard to do, right? I mean, it doesn't make sense to talk about squares of vector fields. The nice thing is, you can do that move in the world of supermanifolds. So what I'm going to do now is going to talk about supermanifolds, and then show you that in the world of supermanifolds, you can take a square root of this ddt, and then doing everything in the world of supermanifolds, you get the space that you want. So what's a supermanifold? Before giving you the definition is, let me say that if M is a supermanifold, then it's easy to say something about the space of smooth functions on it. Maybe the space of smooth functions in the supermanifold is a graded commutative algebra. So, for example, for Z2 graded. For a supermanifold known as M, N, that space of functions is, well, the usual space of smooth functions on Rm, but then tensored with an exterior algebra generated by N odd variables. So this is the exterior algebra generated by these odd variables. So the word odd just means, well, they are in odd degree, and so they anti-commute with each other since they're odd, and we integrate a commutative context. All right, so that's the goal. You know what functions on a supermanifold is. Well, then, what to define what a supermanifold is, you do what algebraic geometers do, right? You know what the functions are supposed to be, so you define follows, so the definition of a supermanifold. One definition of a supermanifold is manifold of dimension MN is usual, say, call the manifold M, has a usual manifold called M bar, dimension M. This is called the reduced manifold. Plus a sheaf of rings, a sheaf of graded commutative algebras, on M bar sheaf, let's say script A, such that locally the sheaf is supposed to look like that. In other words, if you evaluate the sheaf on a small subset U of your ordinary manifold M bar, then it's just the smooth functions on that subset, but with extra variables, maybe n of them adjoined. So that's what a super manifold is. So on supermanifolds, you can then define what you mean by a vector field. So a vector field, now let me do one example. So for example, look at R11. That will be a, sort of our featured hero. A function here on R11 would be something of the form f of t, theta, which is just an ordinary function f plus g of t times this theta thing. Right? So this is the odd variable, and these are ordinary smooth functions. That's what a function on this supermanifold looks like. So now you can define vector fields, as usual, or as derivations. So these are now, of course, graded derivations. On functions. So, for example, on this supermanifold, I have the vector field D, which is D by D theta plus theta times D by DT. Now that's an odd vector field. Meaning, if you apply it to an odd function, you get an even function, and vice versa. So let's apply this thing here to that function above there. So we first differentiate in theta direction. Well, this doesn't depend on theta, so we just left with g. Now we differentiate in t direction, so we get f prime times theta, and then we get theta times g prime times theta, but theta times theta is zero, this is odd variable, so this is zero, so you get this, and then you can apply this thing again, if you do this again, what you end up with is you get up with f prime plus g prime times theta. Notice this thing, that is just the d dt. So in the super world, we found a vector field whose square is equal to the d dt. So that sort of is, we are on the right track here.
Thank you for explaining
this. You're welcome. What? Yeah, in this example, yeah. In general, if you see these kind of formulas, well, they are local formulas. You pick coordinates, but what you do in one chart is sort of compatible with what you do in other charts. In fact, now I'm going to make a definition. So now I want to take this supermanifold seriously, and I want to say, well, you want to replace the one-dimensional manifolds by one-dimensional supermanifold. On this one-dimensional supermanifold, you need a geometric structure, which on the underlying one-dimensional manifold amounts to a metric. Let me give you that definition. Oh boy, this time is really running fast up here. I completely agree with that definition. So a metric structure on one supermanifold called M is an odd vector field. D, think of the one above, such that D squared, so that's an even vector field now, so an ordinary vector field, and that should be nowhere zero. Okay. So in particular, that gives you then a metric and orientation, in fact, a spin structure, on the underlying manifold M bar, since, hey, you have a nowhere vanishing vector field, so you declare that to be the unit vector in your Riemannian metric that you're defining, and that gives you an orientation at the same time. So that's the geometric structure that I want. And then I define sort of the supercategory, or I define a supersymmetric metric EFT of dimension one. One is a functor from, yeah, before we had this Bohrism category of one-dimensional Bohrisms into Hilbert spaces. Now we beef it up a little bit by making a supersymmetric version of that. So this is a supersymmetric Bohrism category, where the objects are 0-1 manifolds, and the morphisms are 1-1 Bohrisms with metric structure. So passing to the reduced manifolds, you see exactly what we had before, but you have everything sort of souped up supersymmetrically. Well, out of time here, minus 2 minutes, so let me just write down the upshot here. Then you can, proposition is, if you look at the space of supersymmetric EFTs, of degree n, that's the space that corresponds to. So now instead of looking at a semigroup of intervals, you're looking at a semigroup of operators parameterized by superintervals. Turns out the parameter space for superintervals is R11, or the part of it that fits over the positive real line into Hilbert-Schmidt operators. And this space here, I didn't want to say that, right? We have never talked about this. And then you can identify this space here. This is a nice space. This is a configuration space. Namely, you have maps from the real line into subspaces of H, finite dimensional subspaces of H, which I think of as configurations, right? So you have to every point lambda, you associate some subspace E lambda. And so you think of the E lambda as being the label of a point lambda, and you only want like discrete many points everywhere. So you have a configuration of points where the labels are subspaces of your given vector space. You want a symmetry condition which says that E minus lambda is equal to the the grading involution applied to E lambda. And then you consider such configuration spaces. That's the kind of stuff that Brehm has looked at a long time ago, and it's easy then to see that this is homotopy equivalent to BL cross V. So in other words, by putting in this supersymmetry, you get from a contractible space of EFTs to a very interesting space which has the right homotopy type. Now, this story can be beefed up, so you want to put in degrees. So you do that the usual way. Say, if you think about the Fredholm model, you put in a Clifford algebra by requiring that everybody commutes with a Clifford algebra, and that way you get loop spaces of this guy. And you want to put those things in then in the definition of this category. So you put systematically Clifford algebras in the definition of this Bodism category. And so if you do that the right way, then you have a notion of a degree that basically tells you what the size of the Clifford algebra is that you put in there. And then if you look at the spaces of Euclidean field theories of degree n, well, you get sort of the nth space of the K-theory spectrum. And then you apply similar ideas to get the result of the partition function of a supersymmetric conformal field theory that I mentioned in the introduction. So again, the supersymmetry is the key for showing that the partition function A is holomorphic and B, that it's integral. So the supersymmetry does a lot for it. Without it, you can't do anything, but with it, you can do a lot. Thank you.